During the retreat so far, we've been talking a lot about the path, how to practice, what works, what doesn't work, how to overcome hindrances. I did mention in the middle of the retreat, or early on in the retreat, sometime or other, a little bit about the development of insight. But one of the reasons why we're developing insight is not just to become smart alecks and being able to argue with everybody about the Dhamma. The purpose of insight is to be free. To be free of defilements, free of craving, and in particular, to be free of rebirth. In other words, to become, as they say, enlightened. But as many of the monks in my monastery who study Pali have kept on telling me that the word enlightenment is not the best translation of the goal of Buddhism. It's a word which has stuck because we use it so often. And enlightenment does seem to mean that we just get wise and smart. It's a measure of our knowledge rather than the measure of our stillness and freedom. And actually, that the word doesn't really mean enlightenment. The word to be a Buddha means to be an awakened one, coming from the Pali root word bujati, to awaken, to wake up. And when you actually change the meaning of our goal, instead of being enlightened, in other words, gaining more understanding and knowledge, which is very Western, if we have the other meaning of being awake, then it gives a completely different nuance to the goal of our path. We're being awake, which means that we have incredibly strong awareness and mindfulness. And we're not just awake in the sense that our mind is very strong and powerful to see things which other people can't see, but it's also awake in the sense it's awake to the truths of life, awake to the problems of life. So instead of being a knowledge which once learned, you try and remember, it is actually a new way of seeing things, being awake to the truths of life, like a complete change in the perceptual framework. So you see things in a totally different way, which is what really the goal of Buddhism is. And once you explain the goal in a much more precise way, again, it makes the whole practice of what we're doing here more comprehensible. For example, some people say, you don't need even to meditate to become enlightened. And those are the people who understand this word enlightenment just to be a body of knowledge which you can remember. When I was a young Buddhist in England, we used to call such people armchair Buddhists. They could write the most profound books on the nature of reality, and they could argue at such a deep level about the nature of the mind and emptiness. But when it came to real life, they were angry and arguing and lusting, and they were a mess. But they could really write some really inspiring books about Buddhism. They were like the armchair Buddhists, we call. The ones who could speak Buddhism, but that's what it was. Just intellectual words, and never got deeper than that. They weren't really awake to what was really happening in life. And so our goal is actually to awaken up to the problems and difficulties in life. And that does give me an opportunity, as an aside to this morning's talk, to mention another skillful means for dealing about hindrances, to be more awake to these problems so they don't trouble you in your meditation. Most of the talks which I give on a meditation retreat are just a practical how-to-do type talks. So really I want you to find out what the answer is yourself when you get there, rather than telling you. Nevertheless, most of today's talk will be telling you what happens when you get there. But, as an aside, one point which I missed out on earlier talks, each one of us has got what we call our major hindrance. The one which keeps stopping us time and time and time again. And the way to awaken to that hindrance and the way to overcome it is using a little simile which I dub the simile of a snake. This is not the simile of a snake in the sutras, this is a different simile. And this comes from my own life as a young monk in northeast Thailand in what was then very poor monasteries before Ajahn Chah became famous. that many of you have been to those monasteries, they're very well developed now. In those days the forest was thick, and the only paths which you had through those forests were very narrow paths. The soil in northeast Thailand was very poor and sandy. It was like white sand. So we'd always maintain those paths through the jungle and keep them well swept. And that was our basic job every afternoon, to sweep the paths. And that was important. And the reason was because at night time, when you were walking back or walking from your hut to the meditation hall or the teaching hall and walking back from there to your hut, there were many creeping things in that jungle. Many beings who looked at you as their dinner. Snakes, scorpions, centipedes, all sorts of creepy crawlies. And they wanted to attack you. So the only way that you could be safe was having very clean paths so that you could see your way. Now what happened sometimes, we would have flashlights, but we were so poor that sometimes there was no batteries for those flashlights. And I remember several times going to see Ajahn Chah, saying, "My battery's run out, have you got any batteries?" Because we'd get all the stores from Ajahn Chah. And he'd look in this big earthen jar, whenever people offered him things, he'd just put it in the jar. And he would share it with any monk who needed it. He looked in the jar, sorry, there were no batteries. No batteries for days. So he didn't have a flashlight. So it meant that after the evening meeting, you'd have to walk back in the dark from the hall to your hut. And being a junior monk, your huts were the furthest. The senior monks got the closer huts. And you knew that there was dangerous snakes around. Scorpions, centipedes, and these biting ants called the motlin, which made you jump if they bit you. All these things were around. And they're all ready to bite you as you walk back in the dark. And very often also, no exaggeration, you see the thongs which we wear. I still wear those thongs now, I got used to them. But sometimes when you wore them and wore them and wore them, the straps got very thin and they would break. And you try and repair them. You wouldn't go and get any new ones because there weren't any new ones. You just repair them. You kept on repairing them until you could repair them no longer. And then you asked for a new pair and there wasn't any. So often you would actually be walking back barefoot without a flashlight through the jungle, knowing all these things were around. So I developed this simile of the snake from those experiences. After the evening meditation, maybe a tour from Ajahn Chah, when I was walking back to my hut, I knew there were snakes on the path and that they were dangerous. And I had no flashlight, no sandals. So when I walked back, I was really awake and aware. I wasn't thinking about the talk which I just heard. I wasn't fantasizing about old girlfriends. I wasn't just dreaming about what I'm going to do next week. I was really alert on that path. Why? Because there were snakes there and I had no shoes on. And so every time you went on that path, because it was swept, you could at least, under the starlight, see shapes across the path. And you couldn't distinguish whether it was a shadow of a tree, whether it was a stick, or whether it really was a snake. Whenever I saw a shadow across the path, I just jumped over it, or I went by a different route. Because I was always alert, I never got bitten by those snakes. And from that I developed the simile of the snake for one's hindrances. Later on this morning you're going to go on the journey of samadhi, of stillness. You're going to walk along this path, and sometimes your mindfulness is not all that sharp, it is dull, and you don't know what's on that path. But if you know there are certain hindrances which are really dangerous, it might be sloth and torpor, it might be restlessness, it might be too much control, whatever is your snake, identify it at the beginning of the meditation. So you're on the lookout for it throughout the whole period of meditation. In the same way, I was always on the lookout for snakes. And if you're always on the lookout for that one hindrance, only choose one as your snake for each meditation. When you're on the lookout for that hindrance, you will see it before it grabs you and bites you. If it's sloth and torpor, you'll see it before it sort of envelops you in its misty shroud, and you'll be able to take another path. As someone told me years ago, and it's such a beautiful simile, meditation is a journey on a road, and there's a fork in the path. And one fork leads to sloth and torpor, the other one leads to peace. If you can notice that, you can always take the fork in the road which leads away from sloth and torpor to awareness and peace, but not dullness. It is like a fork on the path which, if you're not alert enough, you miss. Restlessness is the same. It's a snake waiting to bite you and cause you a lot of restlessness. So if you can see it before it comes, because you're awake and alert to it, like a simile of the snake, you can avoid it easily. Like I always avoided those snakes on the path at night in Wat Pa Phong, with no flashlights and no sandals. I was aware. So this is another way of programming mindfulness. What is your hindrance, your snake? Begin your meditation. Tell you, that's my snake. And then you'll always be on the lookout for it, which means it will never catch you. It's another way of awakening the mind. So going back to the main topic of this discourse, like enlightenment, it's like really being awake and alert, especially awake and alert to the problems of life, and awake and alert to a new way of seeing things. So not only is it mindfulness, it's mindfulness with wisdom as well. What I mentioned, Ajahn Chah would always say, satipanya, mindfulness together with wisdom. Sometimes the people call that sati sampajanya. Sampajanya just means with panya. Panya is a contraction of pajanya. And understanding that, which means we get a good idea of what we should be practicing. More mindfulness, more wisdom. And the wisdom we develop is on the nature of things. As you develop deep meditation, you do start to see things in a different way. I already mentioned you see sort of the nature of the body when it disappears. You can only know what the body is when it vanishes. You may think you can understand the body, but when it's gone you see things in a completely different way. You may think you understand the nature of the will, and you know, who you think you are, and that you're in control and making all these decisions. But when you go into these jhanas and will disappears, you come back afterwards, you never think that you're in control ever again. Sometimes you may forget and think you're in control, but you're not. I remember the monk who took over from Ajahn Chah in Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Liam. He's also a very good monk. It's very fortunate that in that tradition we had an Ajahn Chah, the next monk who took over, maybe not quite the same level as Ajahn Chah, but pretty well up there. I remember just visiting him once, and I asked him the question. It was like a common question which abbots ask each other. It's almost a tradition to ask this question. Are your monks easy to teach? That's the question abbots ask each other. And Ajahn Liam just quite nonchalantly said, yeah, they're so easy to teach. And I knew that was something wrong there, because you know, being a teacher is very, very difficult, because people have got to define them. They're really good monks, good nuns, but you know, they're not perfect, and so they'd always sort of, you know, have their idiosyncrasies, be stubborn sometimes, be argumentative. That's par for the course. And I was the same. So, what do you mean your monks are easy to teach? And with a smile he said, oh, it's easy to teach them. When they want to go that way, I let them go that way. When they want to come this way, I let them come this way. That's why they're easy to teach. And of course, you know, this, but monks do joke, but these are jokes with profound meanings. What he was saying is he doesn't control them. He teaches them, encourages them, inspires them, but no way does he control them. If he controls them, then they're just so difficult to teach, and he has a lot of suffering. And I understand that, so I don't control my monks. Maybe sort of I do it sort of so they don't understand they're being controlled. Because monks are very, very good at psychology, so there's a way to do things. Same with you as well. It's called brainwashing, conditioning, suggestions. But instead of trying to control things, we realize that how can you control things when there's no will? Or when the will is just a process which is completely apart from you? And so those are sort of insights. They're the insights which make you enlightened. The insights that you're not in control. That craving is just not part of you, it's just a process. And sometimes you look back with your insights and with your mindfulness and find, well, why do I choose to do this? Why did I decide to build a retreat center? Why do I decide to teach like this? Why do I tell jokes? I remember one day just sitting down and contemplating, you know, my character, why is it like this? And you look back, it's totally conditioned. Now, first of all, by my father, who loved telling jokes. Now, he was a man who sort of initiated that joke years ago. Maybe a premonition that one day I was going to become a monk. He was the one who came home from work one day and said to me, he said, "What fun does a monk have?" And before I could answer, he said, "None." So I remember that. That came from him. So that's the sort of father I grew up with. And so he's conditioning me. And just, you know, the way that we talk, you know, if he's monks of the forest tradition, you see how much Ansha teaches. And, you know, we've been conditioned by him to teach like this off the cuff, no preparation, you know, from the heart, based on experience, a lot of stories. And so that's the conditioning which we have. So sometimes I look at myself and say, who's giving this talk? And it's certainly not me. I remember having one of those very, very spooky experiences many years ago. Many years ago, we just moved into our temple in Nolamara, and our library was then in what's the reception area. And one Saturday morning, just waiting to go an arms round without anything much to do, I was just fossicking through the library of recorded, the old cassette tapes. And I just happened to notice there was a talk which I gave years before on the same subject which I gave the night before. I forget what the subject was, but I remember what I said the night before. And I wonder how my talks have developed over those 5 or 6 years. And as I started playing the previous talk 5 or 6 years earlier on the same subject which I'd gave the night before, it was just goosebumps again. When I was repeating almost verbatim, word for word, what I'd said just the night before. Whole paragraphs were exactly the same. And that night before, I thought I was just choosing the words I was going to say. I thought I was in full control of the talk which I was given. But I realized I'd repeated myself, not just the subject matter, but almost verbatim, word for word. And then I realized that what I'd just been saying the night before was not coming from will. It was conditioning, a way of speaking, which was in the brain. And it just came out. And the spooky thing was, I thought it was will. Getting into your idea of will and choice, that's a very powerful area for insight. This is where you really find out and exactly, not so much who you are, but who's doing things. Who is in control? And you'll find that doing things and control is part of the sense of identity and self. The Buddha once said a very profound thing, wherever there is a self, there is something which you own and possess. Where there's something which you own and possess, there will be a self. The idea of a self, this is actually what it does. Instead of looking upon the self as a thing, look upon it as a function. In other words, what its role is, what its job is, what it does. Just like a human being. You know, you call me a monk. Why do you call me a monk? It's because what I do in life. You may be an engineer. Why do you call yourself an engineer? Because it's what you do. You may be an accountant, a real estate agent, a doctor. Why do you call yourself a doctor? It's defined by what you do. And so, what is a mind? It's defined by what it does. And what it does is own things. And whatever it owns and possesses, it wants to control. That's why we control things, because it's mine to do with as I will. And you find that when you realize there's no will, there's no ownership either. When there's no ownership, then there's no self. So by letting go of things, especially by letting go of controlling, you are letting go of yourself. Your identity, your I, your me, is vanishing. That's why sometimes it gets scary. Many of you in your interviews have come up and said you got to a certain point and you were afraid. And that fear, sometimes you investigate, why are people afraid in meditation? What are you afraid of? You're just about to get the bliss better than sex. Isn't that nice? What are you afraid of? Coming to meditate for years and now you're getting somewhere. What are you afraid of? Why can't you just reach your aspirations and have fun? And usually I've noticed that fear is always when you're about to lose something which you're very attached to. It could be something physical, but more often something emotional, mental, personal. And you'll find that at these stages of meditation, you're about to lose something. When I say you're attached to it, I'm saying it's such an important part of your identity. It's part of you. And so letting it go is almost destroying a part of yourself. It actually is destroying a part of yourself. That's why it's very scary. So in this part of meditation, you do come across the barriers of fear. But when you ever do get fear come up in the meditation, realize it's only you're letting go of something you think you own, which you think you possess, which you think is part of your identity. And have at least a bit of faith. The Buddha said, you own nothing. You came into this world with nothing, you leave with nothing. You came into samsara, not even with a mind. And you're going to leave one day parinibbana with not even a mind, let alone a body. So you've got nothing to lose. Which is why you can overcome that fear and just go that next step and see what it's like to let go of things. It's freedom. But also it comes at a cost. Comes at a cost of letting go of your identity and your sense of self. And your sense of control as well. So as you go deep in meditation, those fears are great signs. When someone comes along and says they got fear, great, you're actually, at last, you're confronting an attachment. You're right there, as they say, the coal face. You're at the front line of battle. Using a not very good simile, but battle. But you're right there, you're doing the work. You're about to let go of something big. That's why you get fear. So you just understand what that fear is. Go beyond it. Let it go. And you see that you do own nothing. So as you meditate more and more, as you get closer to enlightenment, or rather to awakening, you lose more and more of yourself. More and more of what you thought you were. You lose your area of control. I don't know what type of relationship you are in, but sometimes people with big egos, they try and control their partner. And the relationship is no relationship at all. It's just very, very fraught. Unstable usually will end in acrimony. Why do people want to control their partner? Fear again. They think their partner is my husband. It's my wife. It's not your husband. It's not your wife. You don't own them. You haven't got property rights on them. You haven't got like a deed which says, husband belongs to me. Your children do not belong to you. You're trying to control them, you just ask for more suffering and pain. But why do people think they own these things? And in this meditation you may be able to find out that not only your house, your car, your bank accounts, certainly your shares don't belong to you. Many people have discovered that recently, because they've all disappeared. But now you're finding out even your body doesn't belong to you. So you aren't a girl, you aren't a boy, you aren't Sri Lankan, you're not Australian, you're not Chinese, Your body is, yes, but that's not you. So you have to let it go. When it doesn't belong to you, it's easy to let it go. The very beginning of this retreat, I asked you to use the mantra, or just the concept, not my business. I love that during my meditation. Something comes up, not my business. Nimitta comes up, not my business. Mara comes up, not my business. Whatever happens, none of my business. And it's great then, because when it's none of your business, you detach. Nothing to do with me. Which means you let go. None of my business, you just recognize you don't own these things. It's not your area of control. It's not your sphere of influence, so you let it go. But I apply that not my business, really throughout to everything. It's not just my body's not my business, my breath isn't my business. It can come in if it wants to, it can come out if it wants to, I don't own it. It's not my breath. I don't own my meditation. It's not my meditation practice. And I'm not embarrassed if it goes wrong. I'm not elated if it goes right. It's not my meditation. It's not my practice. So understanding, when you take off this my, then you're awakening to the truth. And then when you start to see it's not my will, now that's the great one. It's not your will, so you can't control it. And as I said, the Buddha made it very clear in the second of his teachings, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta. Remember, these are powerful teachings. These are teachings which enlightened people from scratch, people who hadn't really heard much about Buddhism before. The Buddha gave these teachings and wham bam, people actually saw it and became fully awake. Awake to the fact that there is no will coming from you, it's just a process. Will is there, but it's not yours. Not yours to control and to manipulate. What happens? If you really understand that, you have to let go. You have to be free. One of the definitions for enlightenment is the abandoning of craving. When craving stops. And what do we mean by craving stops? This very thing here. Your identification with the will stops. So you don't think that you're in control anymore. So when things go wrong, they haven't gone wrong, they just go according to nature. When we say things go wrong, it means they don't go according to my plan. They don't go to the way I think it should be. I don't know if you've been sick on this retreat. And think, oh, why did I get sick on this retreat? It's the only time I have to meditate. There's nothing gone wrong, that's nature. What do you expect? If you've been very, very dull and restless, what do you expect? It's just the nature of things. And just go with these things. Eventually the mind settles down and becomes peaceful all by itself. Which is why we don't do so much. Now Ajahn Chah has some amazing similes. And this simile, I should write it in a book someday because I've never seen this in any other book. I've mentioned this in the talks before, but it really needs to be put around more widely. This was what he continued to say for the first year I was at Wat Bapong, and I never understood a word of it. I thought it was crazy speak. In the same way, you know, I keep repeating things, you know, like, make peace, be kind, be gentle, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And I'll say that for about a year, and in a year's time I'll say something else. It's just how people teach. But his big thing in that first year, when I was at his monastery in Wat Bapong, was that Wat Bapong, his monastery, is a mango orchard. And he said the mangoes have been planted by the Buddha hundreds of years ago. And now all those mango trees are mature. And there's thousands of juicy ripe mangoes dripping from the branches of the mango trees in my monastery. And he said, you monks don't have to climb up the tree to get the mango. You don't have to throw sticks at the branches to make the mangoes fall. He said, all you have to do, monks, because of the compassion of the Buddha, is just put out your hand and a mango will fall into it. And that was Ajahn Chah's simile. And I said, that's crazy. I don't know, have you ever sat under a mango tree, put your hand out? How many times has the mango fallen into your hand? It's impossible. So I thought, it's the crazy stuff. I said, if you want to get a mango, you've got to climb the tree. Or get a ladder. Or throw a stick or something at it to get that mango. That's how you get mangoes, isn't it? In the world, yes. But in Dharma, no. So what did he mean? Just put your hand out. Open the door of your heart or your hand to this moment. Don't go throwing sticks into the Bodhi tree. Don't go climbing the Bodhi tree. Don't shake the Bodhi tree. Stop doing things. All you need to do is sit under the Bodhi tree and put your hand out. Streaming in, falls in. Thank you very much. Once returning, non-returning, full enlightenment. Thank you very much. You don't do anything. That's what Ajahn Chah would say. That's a brilliant simile. But you know, you just don't understand it at the time. Because that's actually how these things happen. When you do something, when you shake the tree, the mango sticks hard. When you climb the tree, the mangoes cling on like nothing. You can't pry them off. Throw sticks at them, they just fall back and hit you on the head. But if you just hold your hand down and be peaceful and still and do nothing, then the mango falls. Someone told me another interesting simile many, many years ago. You know there's many birds in this forest. You've seen them flying up and down. Some big birds, some small birds. Did you notice the first few days of this retreat there were very strong winds at night? Where do those birds go at night time? They go up on the branches and twigs of the trees, where they go to sleep on the twigs and branches. Now you can imagine those branches or those trees swaying in those wind. Why isn't it the case that birds fall off? I mean, if you were swaying that much at night, you'd fall out of bed, wouldn't you? So how come the birds, totally unconscious, sitting on their trees, don't fall off at night? Especially in the hard, fierce winds when the trees are swaying. And the reason somebody told me, oh, there's a note for somebody, Bianca? Okay, so can you unlock the phone? We're actually supposed to be getting a phone from Telstra, but Telstra told us another company do the phone, and so we rang the other company yesterday, and the other company said, no, we don't do it, Telstra does it. They know what it's like sometime in the world. You go round and round and round and round and round. It's called samsara. Eventually we'll find out who does the damn phone. But anyhow, in the meantime, where were we? I said, where were we? The birds on the trees, yes. You got the birds on the tree. The reason is that the birds' claws, when they relax, totally let go, the claws close up. The more they let go, the more the claws close. And in the morning, to wake up, they have to put forth effort. They have to try to open those claws. Their natural state is closed claws, which means the natural state when they really let go is very, very stable. So sometimes you look at the birds on the tree and say, they're attached to the tree, they don't fall off. No, they're letting go to the max, which is why they don't move. If they get agitated and afraid and put forth effort, their claws will open up and they'll fall off. That's actually the nature of a bird, and that's really good Dharma, because that's actually how it works. The more you try, the more you fall off of the perch of samadhi or stillness. I remember just when I used to ride a bike, I got a bicycle when I was, I don't know, 6 or 7 years of age. And great, because it's so easy to ride a bicycle until you get on it. And as soon as you get on it, it kept falling off. And it took me a long time to realize why I was falling off. Because I was so stiff. I was so scared of falling off. I was gripping those handlebars until my knuckles went white. My whole body was rigid. So whenever you go around a corner, you just can't move the body to accommodate to the bend. And that's why I kept falling off. The more I tried to stay on, the more I fell off. And when I just let go and just relaxed on the bike, And then you would sort of adjust to the movement of the bike. You'd have more flexibility in your body and your hands, and you stayed on. It was easy then. There's another simile, that the more you try, the more effort you make, the more you fall off. So you learn how just to relax and let go and flow with things. And then you never fall off a bike. And if you ever get reborn as a bird, you always have a good sleep at night without ending up in the middle of the night on the ground with a headache. So sometimes, why do people will and put forth that sort of control? Why do they go try to grab the fruit off the Bodhi tree? Because they think that's the way it's done. Becoming awake to the truth realizes that's not the way it works. The way it works is to let go, relax, be free, put your hand out and don't do anything. Don't expect it to fall. That's doing something. Come on, fall. Look, I'm busy. I've only got one more day to go before I have to go back to Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand or wherever. Come on. It never falls then. Hand out. No expectation, no control, no desire, and then it falls. The other simile, that's Ajahn Chah's simile. It's my classic simile, and again, most of you heard it, I don't know how many times, some of you may not, about the donkey and the carrot. It's a great simile. Donkeys are the most stubborn animals in the whole world, so people say. If you try and get a donkey to pull a cart, you can beat it with a stick and it still won't move. You can't use such punishment to make donkeys pull a cart. The only way you can get a donkey to pull a cart, instead of beating it with a stick, tie the stick to the donkey's back. So the front end of the stick is about 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. Tie a string to the end of that stick, and on the end of a stick, put a nice juicy carrot. If it's a Western donkey. Maybe if it's a Singaporean donkey, like a durian. Whatever it is in front of the donkey. And the donkey, the Singapore donkey, sees this beautiful durian. Yeah, I fancy some of that. And so the donkey will go towards the durian. And because it goes towards the durian goes away from the donkey. Because it's tied on a stick to the donkey's back and the string on the end of the stick. So no matter how much that donkey moves, the durian is always 2 feet in front of the donkey. It never reaches it. Now, do you understand that simile? How much in life has happiness, fulfillment almost been there? 2 feet, you can see it, it's in reach. And you go for it and it moves away from you. Whether it's happiness in your relationship, financial security, it's almost there, and you just go and reach it, and the damn stock market crashes. Or, I don't know what else, like health or success, but especially in meditation. Sometimes you can see the nimitta right there. Yeah, it's there, and you go and reach it, and it goes a bit over there. You go reach it, and it goes over there. You're always chasing it, you never quite get it. Or even enlightenment, suddenly you have these great insights. And it's almost you can understand it, but not quite. So you go reaching for it, and it goes a bit further. That's the nature of life. You can see truth, you can see happiness, you can see fulfillment. When you go and reach for it, it moves away from you. So how does a donkey catch the durian? It's easy. The donkey runs like hell after that durian. Doesn't matter how hard it runs, the durian is always 2 feet in front. That's the effort which you've already put into life. You've already been running fast enough. You don't need to do any more running. But the Singapore donkey, he's probably been to the Buddhist fellowship and he's heard this before. So the donkey knows how to stop. Puts on the brakes, gets skidding and all this smoke comes from his hooves and sparks. As he stops, and as he stops, that durian goes further away than it's ever been before. That's what happens when you let go. Sometimes people are afraid of letting go because they've been meditating before, they can watch the breath. When they let go at first, they get sleepy or they get restless. They can't watch their breath and so they give up and go forcing things again. You have to be a bit patient when you try this method. At first, your peace and tranquility go further away than they've been before. Which is why that you get more sleepy in the first few days of this retreat. Sometimes you get more thoughts coming up. Maybe thoughts of the past which you've been suppressing before. And sometimes you think this thing cannot work. I'm not getting more peaceful, I'm getting more agitated. It's just the jury and going a bit further away. But then something happens which has never happened before in the donkey, which is your mind's life. Sure, the doing is a long way away, but now it starts coming towards you. It's reached the end of its arc and now it's coming back. And nicely, you don't have to do anything. You just wait there patiently. And once you get to what I call that tipping point, and it starts coming towards you, that gives you confidence, inspiration. It's working. You come to me or come whoever else is teaching the retreat, you've got all these wonderful things. Yeah, the joy is coming closer, it's coming closer. And it comes to that normal place, it usually is 2 feet in front of you, where you're used to seeing things. But now, that joy is coming fast towards you. And it comes closer and closer and closer. And what does the donkey have to do? Absolutely nothing. Except to the last moment, it remembers metta, loving kindness. The door of my mouth is open to you, Julian. Thank you very much. And that's how enlightenment works. Now that is a very accurate description of the process of enlightenment. Because it shows how you catch these things. And how it's just counterintuitive until you understand the big picture. And how it becomes stillness, letting go of craving. Sitting under the mango tree, putting your hand out, not shaking it. And then you get enlightened. And no wonder just all these people who became enlightened, but like Angulimala, stop. Now people like, who was it, Patachari, who the Buddha sort of taught how just to let go of all that terrible pain she had of losing her husband, her 2 kids and her parents all on the same day. Drove her crazy. Just by changing an attitude and not chasing after the mango or the durian or the carrot, but allowing it to come towards you. That's how these things work. Not only does it show you the how, but it gives you a good insight into the result. If you are the person who attains Nibbana, if it comes from your struggle and your striving and the application of your will, it just becomes what I called the other day another scout badge which you can wear. Yeah, I've got my degree, I've got my PhD, I've got my enlightenment badge, I've got all these other sort of attainments and medals. And that's completely against, you know, what the Buddha's teachings. It's not about ego and having something which makes you have a bigger sense of self. It's where the self disappears, and with the sense of self disappearing is the will disappearing. When that happens, the will disappears. You also understand that with the will disappearing, a lot of suffering disappears. The suffering of controlling the world. And sometimes being disappointed when you make mistakes. You don't make mistakes. It's not your fault. That's again one of my other favourite famous sayings. When anything goes wrong, I tell them, it's not my fault. What do you mean not your fault? You decided to do this. No, I didn't. It was just cause and effect, not my will. It's a wonderful way of passing the buck when you realise, when you realise there's nobody in there. So maybe you could just pass the button like that. You don't suffer so much. Yeah, mistakes happen in life. You do the wrong thing, or you do a different thing which, you know, maybe you could have done better, but so what? That's life, isn't it? You could suffer a lot if you took too much responsibility. So I call this responsible irresponsibility. They're a little bit irresponsible sometimes. Because really, you're out of control, and life is out of control. Sure, you nudge it this way, you nudge it that way, but it just goes despite you. And sometimes when you don't make decisions, just life goes on anyway. Problems solve themselves, even though you don't get involved. That's why when there's nothing to do, then do nothing. A lot of time there is nothing to do. So why do you do so much? If it really is a problem, as that Howard Macmillan said, and I wrote this in my book, if something is a problem, it has a solution. If there's no solution, it's not a problem. Your family, is there a solution? No solution. If it's not a problem, don't think about it. It's amazing how much time we end up worrying about things which aren't problems, meaning things which don't have a solution. So you're dying. It's irreversible. It's not a problem anymore. There's no solution. Die. So why do people worry about it? So you're broke, you lost all your money in the stock market. It's not a problem. You can't solve it if it's not a problem. You understand what you're talking about there? We worry about things which we have no effect on. And that is real stupidity. And it's also, after a while, we realise there's very little thing we can do in life. So because we understand about the nature of will, we don't take such personal responsibility. Sense of self disappears. We don't feel proud of our achievements because we have no achievements. We don't feel guilty about our failures because we have no failures. We completely let go of everything. Gone. So that gives an understanding of what enlightenment is, what freedom is. Sometimes the people ask about the stages of enlightenment, because we have these stages of enlightenment, three meaning once returning, not returning, arahat. And because people are still into attainments, they want to know where they are. Am I streaming it yet? Am I once returned? Am I a non-returner? They want to know sort of what level of the ego ladder they're on. And that's all it is. It's just thinking you're dividing yourself by your spiritual attainments. This spiritual materialism, that's nothing to do. If a person goes along and wears a big badge, I am enlightened, and wears an enlightenment hat, then they're not enlightened. No way in the world. Anybody who sort of is proud of their attainment can be enlightened. It's letting go of the self. It's abandoning the self. Not sort of making a bigger self by your attainments. So the more you vanish, the more enlightened you are. That's why one of these old Sri Lankan monks, Ananda Mangala, he used to be in Singapore a long time, and he was a very idiosyncratic monk. I remember somebody asked him once, yeah, in the talk, I was just sitting next to him listening. He said, "Are you enlightened yet?" He said, "I'm not enlightened, but I'm highly eliminated." And I thought, what a wonderful way of talking. And I said, "Did you mean illuminated?" So he said, "No, eliminated." So that's another way of understanding enlightenment. How eliminated are you? So the more eliminated you are, the closer you are to nirvana. It's a great one. It says non-self. You're vanishing. You're gone. And that's being highly eliminated. But to understand exactly sort of about these stages, yeah, you can describe the error. A stream winner hasn't got this, and a once returner hasn't got that. But that doesn't really cut any ice for you, because a lot of people are not really sure about, like for the stream winner, no self view. No attachment to rites and rituals, no doubt. It's very easy to convince yourself you're a stream winner. Yeah, I know there's no self. Yeah. And people get very interested when I talk about stream winner, because they say, is he talking about me? Is he talking about me? So I really, 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 really want to be a stream winner. So, forget about that, because that is too ambiguous to understand whether you're a stream winner or not. The best simile was a Buddhist simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors. It's the Anguttara Nikaya. Brilliant simile. Because it brings it down to earth. Or in this case, down to the ocean. Sailors, shipwrecked at sea, seven of them. The first of those sailors goes straight down, drowns. That's like the human being who's made bad karma. Been selfish, hasn't been generous, always been critical, always broken your precepts. Bad person goes down. Second person is the average Joe or Joanne. You know, they're a reasonable person, they're good, but they've got their sort of, you know, little vices. They go up, they go down, they up, down, and eventually, boom, they go down. That's the ordinary person. The third person is the good, virtuous person, who do more good things than harmful things. They've got a natural goodness, virtue, always generous, always there for you, hardly ever critical. And they're the ones who float on the surface. The sailor who floats. And of those sailors who float, number four is a subset of the floating sailor. In other words, someone who is a good person, who does keep precepts, who is kind, who is generous, who gives charity, looks after their parents, looks after people in problems and suffering, always there ready to help. That subset, when you're floating, you can look around. When you're struggling so hard to keep afloat, you can't look around. Your whole attention is just keeping your head above water. But once you've got that all settled, your head's above water, then you can look around. And this poor shipwrecked sailor has been looking around, and he can see dry land over there. He can see safety. He can see how to escape the dangers of being in the sea and drowning. And that's similarly the poor shipwrecked sailor who sees the dry land. That is the stream winner, who's seen safety from suffering, who's seen that yes, by letting go of craving I won't suffer anymore, by letting go of the sense of self there is freedom, by understanding anatta, understanding the Four Noble Truths, deeply understanding them, fully understanding them, you see dry land. And the next stage, you say, what do I have to do when I'm a stream winner to become a wise returner? What do you mean, what do you have to do? It's natural. It has to happen. You can't not go swimming towards dry land if you see it. You have to be just so stupid, you deserve to sink if you see dry land and don't swim towards it. So that's the once returner. You're on your way. You're swimming towards dry land. And you have to know where dry land is before you can swim towards it. And of course, a lot of people, they don't know where dry land is. They don't see the end, the goal, nirvana. And so, of course, they can't even start swimming. They're going around in circles, tiring themselves out and eventually drowning, having to get reborn again and start all over again. But if you saw dry land, you've seen dry land, then you go swimming towards it. That's the once return. And sooner or later, you get so close to dry land, you can stand up in the surf, in the waves, and underneath your feet you can feel the dry sand, or you see the sand of the what's underneath the waves. You're really close to the beach. That's the non-returner. It's the person who's completely abandoned all attachment and concern and interest for your body and for the five senses. You're so close to dry land, it hardly matters at all. And then you just make that final little few steps out of the surf onto the beach. Then you sit under the coconut tree having a nice cup of tea, if you're an English arahat. Or a Sri Lankan one, or a cup of coffee, or whatever you like. So there you are, free at last, having a great time. You've made it, you're safe, you're secure. That's the arahat, the enlightened one. That's a brilliant simile, because it gives you a picture, rather than just a theory, of what enlightenment is. The safety from suffering. The safety from the disappointment, the pain. When you try and control things and it doesn't work out, you put forth effort, it doesn't work, you have pain, suffering, disappointment, and you try to do more suffering, try to do more struggle, more striving, trying to find a way out of this, just through your willpower, rather than just letting it all go. Then you understand what an enlightened being is. An enlightened being should never be a control freak. Anyone's a control freak? No way in the world are they enlightened beings. Control freaks get angry. Because sometimes there's always someone you cannot control. Even though you have rules in a retreat, there's no one, people won't keep them. And there's always one person, or sometimes two, sometimes 60 people, who just will not keep the rules. So what do you do? Ah, if they want to go this way, they can go this way. If they want to go that way, they go that way. That's a lie. So you trust people, you encourage people, you don't control people. So you understand why I run these retreats in this way. There is a Dharma teaching in the way the retreats are run. It reflects something much deeper than just making it easy for you. It reflects actually how the world works. Letting things go, letting things be, not having a schedule, and then people meditate more, not less. Giving you that sense of freedom, letting you go, is giving you a nudge to let yourself go as well. And that way you go on the way to enlightenment. You become a free person. Sometimes they call states of enlightenment states of freedom. And I've done a lot of trying to establish the meaning of that word freedom. And making that point, there are two types of freedom. The freedom of desire, where you can initiate craving, desire, wanting, and follow it and achieve your ends. Have you ever noticed that that type of wanting and desire is a prisoner? It's a prison for you. The more desire you have, the more you feel in a prison. There's also the freedom from desire. The freedom from desire is where you have no desires at all. You don't want anything. Quite happy where you are. Imagine that, sitting here, wanting to be nowhere else, than right here in this moment, on your chair, listening to Dhamma. I don't want to be anywhere else. I don't want enlightenment, I don't want jhanas. I'm just completely happy where I am right now. That is bliss. It's called the freedom from desire. We don't want anything. That's real freedom. Now you understand what enlightenment is. You could be like that forever. Just happy to be here. Completely free of all desires. Not wanting yourself, other people, the world to be different. Completely at peace with things as they are. And of course, when there's nothing to do, that's when you retire. And when you retire, you fade away. Fade. Until you totally disappear. Gone. Forever. At long last. The most compassionate thing you could ever do is to become enlightened and disappear. And you're one less thing other people have to worry about. You get out of the way. It is gone. So that's what enlightenment is. So that today's talk was on awakening, enlightenment, free from desires, and how it happens. Put your hand out and just wait for it to fall. Okay, so thanks for listening. Now, put your hand out. Stop chasing the durian. Stay still and see what happens. Okay, have some good meditation. Very good.